You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Yep, and it's not just my imagination. This is the time of the year that the council gets pretty busy. As you know, there are several annual meetings. Several meetings annually in which all the stakeholders from all over the region come in and talk story. And that's happening pretty soon. And we're going to talk about that. We actually have a two-part program for you, one this week and one next week, in which we give you up to speed, sort of give you a report on what's going on these in the science and statistical committees that have been going on and why that stuff is important as we roll forward to another council meeting. And more importantly, that for some of you out there, I know you're looking forward to it, a Fishers Forum, and this one's going to be a lively one. We're going to tell you when that is and tell you a little bit later on what dates you ought to be saving. But what we're going to talk about now is what's going on at the council right now is something that I didn't know why these letters. But it was SSC. And to help explain that, we've got two council folks here today. One is our friend Malloy Sabater. He is the Island Fisheries Ecosystem Scientist. His title wraps around his car twice, and Josh DeMello, who is a fisheries analyst. And we're going to begin, as always, Josh, with you. Pretty important what goes into the meeting. So I'm guessing that what you're going to talk about a little bit today is explain what these science and statistical committees, what they do, and why do they do their work in front of a council meeting.
So our scientific and statistical committee is one of our advisory groups, and it's actually mandated by the Magnuson-Stevens Act. Mm-hmm. So if you look in the blue book and you look for what advisory groups we have, that's one of them. The other one is the advisory panels. Mm-hmm. And so we talked about
the advisory panels group. Are the guys that are from all walks of the fishery that come in as a panel to guide.
Right. Yeah. And so since those are that's your basic issues, where the issues come from, that, mm-hmm. that ground level type of group in the advisory panel, this is a group made up of scientists, world-renowned scientists, yeah. on fisheries and fishery ecosystems, social economics, and they're meeting to look at what the council is going to talk about, and then provide science advice.
That's what I was getting. And obviously, in a perfect world, science advice would be all about just science. No impact, no agenda. In other words, they take a look at an issue and use their scientific collective thoughts to analyze it and then determine what's going on and then bring it to other people to make decisions.
Right. Yeah. So they try and stay as objective as possible, yeah, yeah. So that they're just providing a recommendation on whether that science is good or whether it's feasible. If there's an issue that comes up, what is the scientific perspective?
Didn't some of the science in the past just be not good? You know, maybe not as reliable as what's been able to be achieved today.
I think it has, and it's also been the best available, so we have exactly. to go with what we have, yeah. and that SSC is the body to say what is the best available for the council.
Okay, Malloy Sabater has been here before, but now he's got a new title, Island Fisheries Economic System Scientist. And I guess maybe sometimes, Malloy, people don't understand what part of the ocean that takes into consideration. Obviously, when you think of ecology, you're looking at usually some land and some water, right?
Right, you look at all factors that's affecting the fishery. Mm-hmm. So what I'm in charge of now is the island fisheries. So mm-hmm. the coastal, near shore, shallower, or deep as the bottom fish yeah. fishery.
Yeah, so you're talking from zero to,
let's just say 400 fathoms.
Yeah, yeah, 400 fathoms, but pretty deep.
Yeah.
And yet it's sort of interesting, isn't it? Because isn't within that category you're talking about several subcategories where the two shall never meet. There's guys that fish right offshore at the reefs that would never go out that into the deep.
Right. So yeah. So what the island fisheries cover is the shoreline fisheries, mm-hmm. boat based mm-hmm. fisheries. The way we structured our FEP is that we've got multiple fisheries within yeah. one archipelagic FEP. So Josh and I are in charge of the archipelagic FEPs, which covers American Samoa, Marianas, Hawaii, and the Pacific Remote Island areas.
You know what I think is sort of interesting? We break ranks for a little bit. We've all gone through this horrific rainfall, and you've certainly seen the brown water and everything else. I mean, isn't that exactly what we're talking about in some cases, where science may support problems are in with this fishery because of the land, not because of the ocean. It's not because of overfishing. It's because too much stuff is getting dumped here.
Right. So that's the reason why the council is engaged in this ecosystem-based fishery management. So when you talk about ecosystem, it's everything, not just fisheries, but also impacts of non-fishery types like land-based sources of pollution, climate change, even nutrient inputs and all other factors. So you have to have a holistic approach when you do your management and not just, looking at the fishery alone as a major factor.
Yeah, that's a good point, because don't we sometimes tend to blame one group of people for something that maybe somebody else did?
Right, and usually fishermen are easy targets.
Oh, yeah, invisible, that's why.
Right.
But what's interesting to me, Josh, we've talked about this on other occasions, is that the enforcement branch locally, whether it be, DOBOR or DAR, it's usually some of these guys, not just the ocean, some of these guys have a mountaintop to the sea, and there's just no way they can be all ears all the time.
Right.
With regards to observation and enforcement.
Right. And so for us, we really depend on the NOAA Office for Law Enforcement to prosecute, and you're looking at to do some boardings as well as the U.S. Coast Guard. But that is a large range that someone from the state has to actually cover.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, it was interesting. A couple of weeks, last week and the week before, some of the things Josh and I were talking about, and also particularly with Eric Kingma, bringing in a couple of guys from the Coast Guard, really was an eye-opener. A lot of people didn't really appreciate how many job hats these guys had to wear on any given time. When that fast response boat goes out, that 150-footer, it's got a chore list that's almost impossible to complete. They got so much to do.
Yeah, and to imagine that that's just for one island area. I mean, you have Guam, Samoa, Sinu Mai, that's just so far out, and they don't have the same type of resources.
Yeah, and I've learned they like us, we call them assets, right? But an asset can be a bucket or a person or a boat or a helicopter. They're all assets to the Coast Guard. But the good one is that they got some new ones, and that must make a lot of the people feel, well, at least they're paying attention. At least we're getting semi-modernized a little bit with some of these vessels. Huh?
We're getting there. We're up there where we can go out and catch all those bad guys out there in the water as well.
Okay, I'm not sure that when we talk about the stats that you guys are talking about, does that come into play sometimes? I mean, Malloy, when you talk about environmental stuff, it should be pretty evident when you see an issue that it causes a problem which causes this problem. But what about the human impact on all of it when you don't see what they're doing?
Yeah, normally you would see some symptoms in the ocean that may point to a source of the problem, and you have to look at all those like a doctor. You have to look at all those symptoms before you can make a full diagnosis of what's
like
the
maybe
is.
A bunch of broken nets someplace.
That
means that some man was there and didn't take up the nets properly, right?
Right, right. So, and not just fishing gear, but also like you said, like runoffs and other pollutants that may have an impact on the fishery stocks, and then the fishery itself is the one that the council and also the state is managing. Yeah.
And by the way, breaking ranks just a little bit again, because I get both these guys to comment on this. Some of you by now will have read or will be reading my latest column in Hawaii Boats and Yachts. And we talk about some of the council stuff there. But we also talk about this derelict net pile that ended up on a beach on the Big Island. I mean, it was unbelievable. A very remote beach, I think it was called the Camilo Beach. And it was like no people go there. And there was this pile of, estimated 40 tons of net and rubbish. That's a pretty clear indication, Josh, that it isn't where it ends up. It's where it started. I mean, obviously, there's nobody using that beach. And look at all the stuff. It's a mountain of stuff.
And it's not nets from fisheries around Hawaii either.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't have those type of nets, those type of net fisheries. So it's really coming from that great garbage patch.
I'm waiting to see some pictures of that. They're coming, by the way. There have been a bunch of aerial photographs. It's huge, isn't it?
Right. It might have been part of that same garbage that was floating in the Ka'iwi Channel not too long ago, couple weeks ago, and part of it ended up off of the surf spots in Waikiki.
Yeah, in Waikiki. And by the way, this pile that they're talking about, at Camilo Beach. It's unbelievable. It shows the scientist, Dr. Ray something, standing on top of it. She looks like this teeny stick figure on this big pile of stuff. And that's not from... Maybe, Malloy, you can explain a little bit. If you look at a valley, and you look at the top of the mountain, and you look out to sea so many miles, it's pretty easy to see what's going on right there, right? I mean, seriously, if you start at the top, sooner or later you're going to get most of it done. But what about how it's impacted from other places that have nothing to do with that piece of property?
Right, and this is a clear example how interconnected we are with the rest of the world, and not just we're not as isolated as we think. Some of this marine debris are probably coming from other countries, from other parts of the ocean, and we are not isolated as much as we thought we are. So we are. So that said, this is like, this is garbage, right? So not only that this marine debris is floating around, coming to our shores, coming from elsewhere, but You can also link this with some of the fish stocks that may be coming from elsewhere, that living things floating around in the ocean and populating our islands.
Some of those things are hitchhiking with that big mass of rubbish, right?
Right.
And they're just going where they go. That's like a bus.
Yep. So larval rafting and all that other biological properties are linked to this marine debris.
But a lot of people, and maybe you can answer this a little bit. There's an awful lot of people that think, okay, we'll just fix it, go pick it up and get rid of it. I mean, but from what I understand, this is just such a massive heap of stuff that it would be impossible to do that. So what can they burn it? What can they do with it? What is going to happen to that mess?
Well, you can always do those beach cleanups all that other stuff, but you're just addressing the symptom and you're not really addressing the source.
You're ending up treating it where it ended up, but not where it started. Is there a way to look at this stuff and say, you know what, this came from Taiwan, or this came from Japan, or this came from Russia?
Yeah, I mean, so there you can look at some of the I believe there during the Japan tsunami. Yeah. I mean, some of those debris also ended up in Hawaii. So sometimes you can identify where the source is, and you can use satellite imagery and some ocean model ocean circulation model to track where potentially those marine debris are coming from.
Okay, let's get a little bit specific. Going back to the 128th meeting of the science committee is coming up, but what's going to be presented is that there's a status of the 127th, and I guess Josh, that's a closed book. The 127th is a closed book, but the information is going to be passed up. Tell us how it's used, what the end result is here.
So at the 127th meeting, the SSC made recommendations to the council, and then the council took it up at its 171st meeting last October in American Samoa. So just like this time, this meeting will feed into the 172nd meeting the week after.
Okay.
And what you're doing is, in this part about the status of the 127th, is looking back to see what happened to those recommendations that the SSC
exactly
made?
That's the real question that I think my listeners would be interested in. Okay, you come up with all this scientific stuff, and you make suggestions. Okay, we as a scientific group have discerned this is where this is, and this is what we think you can do to either mitigate it or make it go away or clean it up. Now, a year later, when you meet, you say, okay, what of our stuff did you take seriously? What are these suggestions were implemented? And then now, will another study show the change? You know what I mean?
Yeah. So what happens here is like this is the feedback loop from the last meeting. So the SSC made its recommendation. It goes to the council, and then it's the council staff's responsibility to keep the SSC informed on what the council did with regards to their recommendation. So this is a continuous process. Some of them can be, like you said, some of these recommendations would be a closed book, but some of them is a continuous work that needs to be done on a longer time period. So we're keeping the SSC informed on what happened to their recommendations. Some of them are short term, some of them are longer term. Mm-hmm. Definitely some of them would need improvements over the course of the year or so. So we're just feeding information to the back to the SSC.
Can you give us some examples of how maybe one of these studies showed something in an area that needed concern and how it was acted on?
Say, for example, the last year we were talking about the ecosystem components. Mm-hmm. They made some recommendations in terms of how to improve on the analysis in filtering species that are in need of conservation and management, which should be managed on a federal level. Mm-hmm. And some of them are going to be ecosystem components. There's no directed fisheries for those species except... but we can, you can manage them through ecosystem means.
Have some of the things that have happened in society helped to show how this can be, how some of the mistakes we make could be corrected, i.e. like the redoing of the fish pond on Oahu at Heiakea, at Heia rather. In other words, there was a lot of things that got introduced there that weren't native, that got, that festered. They cleaned them all up. And I guess now is, are they going to stay away, or, you know, is this a temporary, a lull before the storm, of these species going to come back? How are we going to manage this place?
Right. So for council level management, normally we do it through a plan amendment, and mm-hmm. doing a plan amendment takes several years.
Wow.
And yeah. You know, along the way, when you're developing this amendment and the regulations associated with those amendments, some socioeconomic stuff happens, or mm-hmm. some social event. Oh, it's not social event, because that's parties.
Yeah,
some social conflict, for example.
Well, for example,
that
yeah,
maybe changes the nature of the intent of the amendment.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. Let's say that there's a family that's been using this asset for a long time, and something comes up, and all of a sudden they're going to be prevented from doing that. Nothing that they were doing changed, but the assessment of the environment that they're in changed to the point where you said, okay, whatever's going on, there's got to stop. You know, then isn't that an example of how maybe it impacted somebody socially,
right,
or economically.
And when we do our amendments, we also incorporate impacts to the socioeconomic impacts to the communities and mm-hmm. the stakeholders. So that will have to be taken into consideration before approving a plan amendment.
And that's also something that comes up at the council. So once the science advice is given by the Scientific and Statistical Committee, when it comes to the council should be in tune with what's going on with the fishermen and the fishing community.
Exactly.
You get from the science, and the science says, oh, maybe you can only take this much. And the council will look, well, we can only take this much as a science, but because we have all these families that depend on it, maybe we want to take just a little bit more, take a little more risk, you know, because that the science will always show you how much risk you can take.
What I'm always pleasantly reminded of is that the thought process that goes into that, how much can we take, is it's not made just willy-nilly. It's not just automatically we're going to take whatever this group says. They say 10, we're going to go for 20. It's not that. It's really, don't you look at each individual situation separately to say, okay, what if these guys are wrong with the assessment a little bit? And what if we can take a little bit more and then take another assessment and find out there hasn't been significant change? Wasn't that the right thing to do?
When you're doing stock assessments and you're doing things like annual catch limits, you're not looking at just one hard number. You can't just put it into the sausage grinder and come out with one number. Yeah. You're really looking at the probabilities that you're actually going to take more fish than it can keep reproducing and survive as a stock. So you're looking at percentages, like there's a 50% chance that if we catch it at this level, mm-hmm. then the fish will stop repopulating itself. So when you get into that, the council is always going to be looking at what level of risk they should take based on the scientific advice from the SSC. So something like if the SSC says we should only take a 40% chance of risk, maybe the council says maybe we can go a little bit higher because of these certain social impacts that might occur.
Hasn't a prima facie example of that been the re-looking at tuna, especially in the greater Pacific, that maybe the stocks are healthier than some earlier studies would have suggested, and that the quotas are that is sustaining. In other words, that fishery doesn't need any tweaking. It's working just fine.
Well, I'll give you a more local example. So in this, at the 128th meeting of the SSC, the Science Center would be presenting the stock assessment for the main Hawaiian Island deep seven bottom fish.
Okay.
So this is a stock that we're really interested in.
These are the money fish we're talking about.
The local red fish, money fish that we have. And in this assessment, it was reviewed by a panel of experts, mm-hmm. and it passed the review. Therefore, the SSC will hear the final version of this assessment. And what this assessment, the feature of this assessment is that they incorporated a cleaned up data set based on inputs from the fishermen through a series, like maybe five or six series of data workshop between the scientists, the managers, and the fishermen.
Right.
So they use that better data to define the fishery, to define the stock, and incorporated that into the assessment. And at the same time, they used information from a fishery independent survey working with the fishermen and built that information into the stock assessment that resulted in an assessment that where the stock status is more optimistic than we thought.
I was going to say, and didn't that also speak? I know that there's several people that I know that are in council and on the advisory committee and fishermen. There aren't that many really serious bottom fishermen. I mean, you would think there's a lot of weekend warriors that go out and stuff. But I mean, as far as going out day after day, it's a tough business, especially when there's so many closed off areas. Aren't some saying, look, why are we closing off an area when we know that area to be prolific and fruitful? Why would we shut down an area where there's fish that could be taken? There's not that many people fishing. What's the reason they're doing that?
Right. I mean, that's the whole thing about this whole precautionary approach, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you look at the history of management of the bottom fish in the, was it in the late 80s or early 90s, where we used to use spawning potential ratio as a means to determine whether a stock is overfished or
overfished. By the way, most of us never understood what the heck that was all about.
Right, yeah. Right. So this is the amount of fish that are out there that's reproducing, and we thought that based on the initial assessment during that early period that this stock is in bad shape. Mm-hmm. But with improvements in the data, improvements of working with the fishermen in interpreting those data, Now it shows that the stock is healthier than we thought.
And that's why I said that. And I know, Josh, at the council level, you guys hear that from all the time. As a matter of fact, we're going to ask you guys and gals to save the date of March 14th. That's the next Fishers Forum at the Pomaikai Ballroom. It's free. We'll tell you a little bit more about that. But I think that comes as a great relief to some people that say, hey, wait a minute. These fish are in great shape. And we're not taking that many of them. So how do you get your voice heard? I don't know how to ask this question of either of you, but how do you get them to take a look at something, the science of it? Say, okay, this doesn't look like a biased report. Let's go ahead and let these guys catch a little more.
I think that's something that the bonefish fishermen have been just harping on the scientists for 10, 15 years almost now, and just getting them to understand that the fishery is really weather dependent. If it's really windy, they're not going out fishing.
They can't. It's too tough.
And they come to the council meeting. They make their public comment to the council. They come to the SSC meeting. Mm. They make the public comment on what they think the data says. And if it's not what they see actually out on the water, they'll see it. Yeah. And the bonefish fishermen have been really good at doing that. And so have, for the most part, the longline fishermen as well. But some of those other fishermen really need to come out and...
Yeah, and by the way, you guys and gals, you cannot wait for the same handful of people to do all your work. I mean, that's the other thing. That's why I hope many of you show up. Just curious, Malloy, as put on your scientist hat for a minute. And when we talk about these fish, we're talking about the deep seven. We're talking about seven different fish. Can some of those be more impacted than others? In other words, when you're out there bottom fishing, if you know your hole and you know that's where you catch your paka, you're likely to catch your paka. But there's some places where you're fishing for one species and you get another. What about that as being able to say, are some of those seven more impacted than others, or are they all pretty similar?
Right. So so this is a species complex of seven species, right? So it's the landings are predominantly opaca-paca.
Mm-hmm.
And but we're managing it as a complex because you're not, you know, you go out, you're not really just targeting opaca-paca, but you're also getting other species,
sure,
which is part of the deep seven. That's why they're being assessed as a complex. There are some species that are harvested more compared to others,
mm-hmm,
and that's incorporated, or that uncertainty is also built into the stock assessment. So that's accounted for. So when we choose the level of risk to which the fishery is going to be managed, we will have to take that into consideration, that it's spitting out a number for a complex, but knowing that, you know, some species are targeted more than others, then that will have to be accounted for. And
when you say targeted, you mean sometimes it's easier for me, the fisherman, that I know that ground over there and I know I'm going to catch that fish. That's what I want.
Right.
You know, so if I'm catching paca and I catch maybe a couple of gindai or kali or something, I'm going to keep them. I'm going to probably still sell them, but that's not why I went out there.
Right. And the bottom fish fishermen know that if you go to this certain fishing ground, you know that you're going to be getting X, Y, and Z species.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you deploy your hook at a certain depth, you're going to be getting, you know, paca, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
If you deploy it on a shallower depth as compared to onaga, which exists on a deeper
depth.
Deep
water, yeah.
And one feature of this assessment is that they also looked at a single species, which is paca, which is the driver for this deep seven
fishery. I wonder why that is. It just because of the nature of it, its edibility, its popularity, its size, maybe, and the way that chefs and restaurants seem to like them?
Well, it's a combination of all those.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in the end, when you look at the assessment, it just shows that paca is dominating the catch.
Mm-hmm.
So there's either preference towards paca, or they're more marketable, or, you know, there's just multitude of different factors why paca seem to be a dominant driver for the deep seven complex in terms of the assessment.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. And Josh, I do know that we've all seen at the forums kind of heated arguments about that, right? I mean, when you start, and it's not just the people that are doing it for money. I mean, isn't it also sometimes when you take in the management of a fishery, taking in the local concept of it? I'm not just talking about offshore. I'm even talking about, I mean, onshore, but even offshore. Isn't it true that there, for want of a better expression, there aren't that many bottom fishermen around? There used to be a lot more than there are now. It's maybe it's too hard. Maybe they got to go further. Maybe it's too expensive to go. Maybe the weather. Maybe. But the bottom line is, it's not a growing category. It doesn't seem to be anyway.
I think overall fishing has just declined. It's just because you have a lot more options now.
Yeah.
Before, you went fishing because you needed to feed your family.
Exactly.
And now we have McDonald's hit with the filet of fish, right? And there's tons of other restaurants popping up all over.
I couldn't help but watch the other night. There was an Arby's commercial on. It says Hawaiian bread. And I think, well, and where's the, it, we have the meats, but it was talking about chicken. It was talking about fish. But that's true, right? Malloy, maybe some of your experience, for those that don't know, you originally came here to Hawaii from where?
American Samoa.
Yeah, and in Samoa, you said you were a city boy. So, you know, a lot of the things that you ate were the things that sort of took over the main menu of people in Hawaii, right? I'm corned beef and Spam and Vienna sausages and all of these things may not be good for you, but they were available.
Right, that's also another aspect that changes the fishery sometimes.
Yeah,
you know, I've seen this substitution of fish meat to other kinds of protein, and you know, that really drives the demand, and you know, there's not a lot of people who's engaged in the fishery, you know.
Recently. Well, listen, some people get priced out. I mean, some species, I guess, are so hard to get and so controlled. By the time they get into a serving size in a restaurant or in a package in a grocery store, are cost prohibitive for a family that can say, I can go down to the reef and poke this or buy a can of Spam for that matter.
Yeah, and it's not only on that aspect, but it's also within a fishery, for example, the market demand is really driving, mm-hmm, you know, how much a commercial fisherman, for example, would go out and catch fish, because if you flood the market with, you know, with a lot of fish, than the market can handle, then the price of the fish goes down.
Just drop like a stone.
So this whole dynamics of demand, economics, and fishery will have to be looked at in an integrated manner.
When you first came here, were you like me and Josh that we sort of know that our fish is a little bit more expensive here because it's better taken care of and it's fresher and it's sort of more desirable? You know, I mean, the reason I ask that is because right now in Samoa, from what I understand, there's fewer fishing boats inshore than there used to be. And the longline boats, they can only, the Samoa can only take so many fish.
Right. And, you know, those small boats, given that, you know, there's also logistic issues associated with that. I mean, if your boat, if your outboard engine breaks down, for example, then there's only like one or two shops in there that can,
in the country,
on that island that can fix the engine. Yeah, and normally it's a long queue before your engine can be worked.
Here in Hawaii, Josh, we're such an instant gratification society, right? You call up the repair shop. What time tomorrow can you fix my engine? You know, it's not. And if you can't fix it tomorrow, I'm going somewhere else. But I guess in Samoa and other places, not as many choices.
Yeah, and you're lucky if you get to fix it in a week or a month sometimes.
That's why sometimes when you see a boat being sold in that part of the world, I've always loved it, with two extra engines. You know, in other words, they already know that. They know that, you know, I'm just not going to get this fixed. I'm going to have to change it and send it over here and get it in a month.
Right. And also the commercial fisheries in American Samoa is using an aluminum double-hulled Aaliyah. Yeah. And, you know, although those types of boats are like... rigid.
Yeah.
But you know, with the younger generations, the skills in driving those kinds of boats are starting to become more and more limited.
Yeah, I think they actually want more comfort. They don't like the rain and the bumpiness and everything else. Those are boats that are something like pangas, where they're 28, 30 feet long at the most.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to do part two of this this series that we're talking about next week. But I want to make sure that before we go for this episode, Josh, that people understand sort of what's going on. This is all going to be feeding forward to what's going to be happening in March 13th, 14th, and 13th through the 16th. And that's the 172nd meeting. How much of what you think that we've talked about today is going to go into those forums?
I think a lot of the stuff on bottom fish, mm-hmm. we have a lot of pelagics, action items, we call them, that the council is going to actually look at and make recommendations mm-hmm. on. There's some other stuff on knowing what species of ecosystem component or what species we should classify as ecosystem components. That's going to be talked about, at least from the science side. And then it's going to go into the council meeting the week after.
Yeah, and by the way this happens is the only opportunity – for those of you that want to be there for the Fishers Forum, is on Wednesday night, the 14th, and that's going to be at the Pomaikai Ballrooms in the Cannery Complex. And you're welcome to come. That it's free. There's going to be a lot of stuff, including a panel of some of us in the media talking about the big stories and some of that stuff. And that's kind of a fun thing, you know. But I know it's part of the big meeting. But there's also ways that people get input and give their concerns before these meetings. What are some of the ways people can contact somebody if they have a concern and they want it looked at other than at the forum?
You can always email us at info.wpcouncil@noaa.gov.
Yeah.
You can call us at 522-8220 or check out our website, wpcouncil.org.
Yeah, and I recommend that wpcouncil.org check-in a lot. It's just becoming a fountain of information. You can also hear these shows. They're archived there. But mainly we want you to know that all of this is going on. And that's why, once again, Malloy, your observations, because you came from away from Hawaii in the very beginning, is this is truly bottoms up. I mean, I can't look at anything else that realizes the importance more of people that are not employees of the council or government employees to come to these meetings and be a part of it. It must be, you know, gratifying for you guys too to know that so many people care.
Right. And really we want to promote that bottom-up approach. You know, that your voices are important to us. You know, you should be, your opinion should be heard by the federal government. We are your bridge to the federal government when it comes to fishery management and fishery management decisions.
Yeah, I know, Josh, that there's some environmental groups that that almost mislabel the council as the longline guys. You know what I mean? And in actual fact, the longline management, if you will, is a big part of what you guys do, but it's not the whole thing by any means.
The longline industry in Hawaii is the biggest fishery we have.
Yeah.
We don't have the big salmon or cod or crabs that some of these other places
have. They just
have.
Dwarf us in poundage.
Oh, yeah. But we still hold our own because of the market for the fresh ahi is one of the top five in the nation in terms of harbors.
Will there be discussion about those species of marlin that are being able to be sold? I do know there's going to be concern at the forum to make sure that this opportunity remains. Is there anything that you know of that's threatening that right now?
For marlins, there's actually legislation in Congress that's looking at reducing the ability for any marlins or billfish caught in Hawaii or our region actually to be shipped over to the mainland.
Yeah.
They already have a no selling of marlin on the East Coast, and you can't ship over your billfish from the West Coast.
Yeah, it's somewhat puzzling to people that are familiar with the fishery, especially the long timers that know that there's an awful lot of fish around, and there is a demand for it. I can remember, I'm sure that you guys have heard this before, that when you caught a marlin back in the 70s and 80s, you'd be lucky if you got 30, 40 cents a pound for the fish.
And it's still not very high, but it's real good eating fish that is both cultural in some of our islands and as well as it's just, that's the type of fish we got. So that's the type of fish we eat.
And by the way, It's all about the perception, Malloy. In American Samoa, a marlin feeds an awful lot of people. And I know that they make a lot of really interesting raw and cooked dishes with marlin meat.
Right. And, it could feed the whole village.
Oh, yeah. It's that simple. One marlin. Okay, we hope that you've learned a little something. I want to invite you to go back to wpcouncil.org and find out more about this. So what we've talked about today was a little bit about this sort of scientific stuff, the science and statistical committees. And when we come back next week, we're going to continue this discussion with Malloy and Josh. And particularly, we're going to highlight some of the things that are happening in the 172nd council meeting. We'll tell you all about the agenda, what's happening, and where it's going to be, and how important your input is, and how you can get to wpcouncil.org and really make a difference. And remember, if you want to hear something on the show, we're here for you. You can email the Mike Buck Show at gmail.com, or you can go to wpcouncil and go to the info, go to the click there and click it through and tell them what you want to hear. Remember, you are. It's a bottoms-up deal. So have a terrific week. We'll see you next time.